This episode is brought to you by Windrose Recovery, a family of premier addiction treatment programs in southeastern Wisconsin. Privately owned, Windrose Recovery offers a full continuum of personalized care for those struggling with addiction, including the Manor for residential treatment, Midwest Detox for inpatient detoxification, and Windrose Counseling for outpatient treatment. With highly personalized treatment focused on trauma, Dr. Chantel Thomas and her expert team offer an authentic experience, creating the kind of deep emotional change that's crucial for long-term recovery. If you or someone you love is struggling with addiction, call Windrose Recovery at 414-409-5300. You can learn more about Windrose Recovery by clicking the link in the show notes or by visiting windroserecovery.com. Thank you for listening to The Path to Authenticity. My name's Tom Gentry. I think of the show as the opposite of small talk. You'll hear real conversations with real people who know who they are. We talk about what makes them who they are, how they became who they are, and how we might become truer expressions of who we are.
This is Alicia Crossley, and this is The Path to Authenticity.
Nowhere to run, nothing to hide from the government's prying eye. Take yourself a summer holiday.
The Path to Authenticity proudly supports the I Speak Media Foundation, advancing media literacy education through an evolving series of outreach programs within the communities that need it most. For more information, visit ispeakmedia.org. This is your first time here. Thanks for checking it out. If not, thanks for coming back. I'm Tom Gentry, and this is The Path to Authenticity. Episode 120 for April 27th, 2021, featuring Alicia Crossley, who hosts a podcast called Imperfectly Polished, which targets female entrepreneurs. She's a photographer and a writer, and we go pretty deep in this conversation. I enjoyed it. This is the first of two parts. The first part, we talk about her life, kind of how she got here. And then in part two, she talks a lot about her childhood. But I think you're going to like it, and you should check out her podcast. Also, follow me on Clubhouse. I'll leave a link in the show notes. One of the things that I'm going to start doing here in the near future is record the episodes on Clubhouse. Most of the time when I interview someone like Alicia, it's over the phone. And I thought it would be cool to do it on Clubhouse, where people can listen live to the conversation. Then I can release it as a podcast episode afterwards. So anyway, Alicia's great. You're going to love this. So here we go. Alicia Crossley.
Key West a couple weeks ago.
Okay. So is that when you went to the Hemingway house?
Yeah. Okay. I did.
Yeah, I love that place.
Me
Isn't
too.
That cool?
It was gorgeous. I went with a friend, just, you know, kind of a girl's trip. And one of the big things, though, she had been there and I had not. And being a literature major, Hemingway and Fitzgerald, like the expatriates, that's my jam. Mm-hmm. And so we went to the Hemingway house, and I went with this idea that I was going to sit for a couple of hours and write in the garden, write the book I'm working on, write on the book, right? And there was such a very, very intentionally, I felt a very intentional energy that was, no, this is not where your book is to be written. This is not where you're supposed to create. And it was very affirming, though, thinking you need to go to that kind of source to get creativity or to find your voice, talking about authenticity.
Right.
And I just really felt like there was this push of go pet the damn cats and go away. You're not like, get put the novel down, Alicia. This is not where you're supposed to write, just because this is where masterpieces, you know, were started and finished and think like, this is not your story. And it was just really cool too, but not what I expected.
Yeah. Well, you know, it just kind of affirms that, you know, the best thing we can do as writers is be who we are. Right.
Exactly.
And write what we know and, and let it, you know, channel it. Right.
Yeah. And be inspired by our story and our surroundings and our experiences. I think only be motivated and, you know, look to the past masters with a sense of awe, but not draw so much inspiration from their experience and story.
Yeah. So talk about your book.
Yeah. So it's weird, first of all, Tom, I'll say, speaking about it tangibly, because for years I've wanted to write the book. You coming from the background you do and doing the work you do, I'm sure can understand and appreciate this. I wasn't ready for many years. So it is a memoir, and it's focused on growing up with two parents who were just completely immersed in their addiction and their struggles that went far back into a generational cycle of trauma. So early on, you know, I recall having to fend for myself, survive, and look towards people to see how they were reacting to me and how I could perform to be receptive and appreciated. And that was good in a lot of ways because it helped me survive. It helped me become a great academic student, make the right friends because I wanted that affirmation and the opportunity to belong so desperately. And then it also caused a lot of trouble the older I got and, you know, just nothing ever major, but certainly experiencing growing up without supervision and this over people pleasing mentality. But yeah, the book focuses on not so much, you know, here's all the things that happened to me. That's really what I'm trying to avoid without rewriting the narrative. There are a lot of really hard things. It's a hard read, but ultimately it's coming to the terms as an adult who's a mother and a wife and holds a graduate degree that given all of those things, life is still really damn hard. And my parents came into it with none of those resources. And though it's not an excuse for their choices, I am able, and this is the goal of the book and for the reader, to see them through a lens of humanity that I did not know existed when they, when I was younger, or even up until maybe 5-6 years ago, after a lot of work on, first of all, acknowledging that these things have and had affected me, and starting to deal with that pain.
Yeah. You know, being a person in long-term recovery myself and growing up among alcoholics and a lot of heavy drinking, I get it. I you know, the adapting that we do as children to survive the environment that we're in, and then, you know, we get into adulthood and we continue those things, you know, we continue to act out our lives with these skills that we developed in a dysfunctional environment. And then they don't work so well with the rest of the world.
Exactly. Yeah. There's a point, and I think, you know, us talking about this as well, I'm 36 and 7 months ago, I was diagnosed with ADHD. Early on, you know, from the time as a preteen, and I had extreme anxiety, and understandably so, always looking to my mother to see, you know, is she using, is she about to use, being hyper aware of that cycle that she was always in and where I was in it and how I could protect myself. But I had a structure from school. I had a set of rules, if you will, and a stage that I loved of friends and activities, and threw myself into that wholeheartedly. But there was a script to follow. And then comes college and grad school. I still have a decent script. You know, I still want to please. I still want to make those goals. We continue on, like you said, into the real world. And now there's marriage and there's children and I own a business. And there becomes a time where, as an entrepreneur especially, right, you have to decide what those guides are, what that actual structure of your life looks like. And it was just, it was impossible for me to put the things together that had been put together for me in the academic world. I felt just messy and, you know, overly forgetful. And I was always that person a bit in school, you know, the girl who's always a little bit late, the girl whose binder's always a little messy, like the mad creative, right?
Right.
But in hindsight, it makes a lot of sense, the hypersensitivity. And, you know, we look at that trauma narrative too, and or at least I am now, I've become hyper-focused on hyper-focusing because I'm now so enthralled with learning more about ADHD and seeing it through my childhood through that lens and understanding how that the trauma and that experience and what was once diagnosed as generalized anxiety, how certainly, you know, it was masked ADHD. I was able to cope well and put on the right costume at the right time until I wasn't.
Yeah. So you were diagnosed with generalized anxiety disorder rather than ADHD up until very recently.
Yes.
And, you know, knowing about how that is treated versus how ADHD is treated, I mean, two very different classes of drugs.
Very different. Yeah.
And that in and of itself can be a whole ball of wax to deal with.
Oh, for sure. Well, and that's the interesting part about it. I think, you know, the anxiety was a byproduct of the ADHD in hindsight. I did have anxiety. I do have anxiety, but it's that overthinking. I'm combo. And if, you know, being with your background, you'll know, you probably know so much more about this than I do about me, which is great. But inattentive and the hyper, depending on where I'm at in my life and what's happening, I could go either way. And so the anxiety became very crippling for me. One, from being in the actual environment I was in with my mother, and being afraid of what was going to happen next and trying to always watch over my shoulder and just waiting for that next shoe to drop. Then trying to be pleasing in school and never mess up and just put a lot of pressure on myself to get out of that cycle. So in hindsight, you know, it wasn't inaccurate. That anxiety was definitely there and still is, but the medication, I do medicate. I know so many people in different communities I'm in have such a great perspective on what works for, you know, each person individually. And I say I meditate and I medicate. And for me, so far, and this is, you know, again, 7 months new, it's been like getting glasses the first time in my life. And most definitely one of the main reasons the book is being stitched together right now compared to never before.
Just because you're more focused.
Yeah. Able to focus, able to stick to projects, able to keep a level of discipline that is not just dependent on that internal or external motivation. Which that dopamine need, and you know, those with ADHD like myself, that's a hard, it's a hard thing to become disciplined without some kind of external motivation. So I've learned how to trick myself, Tom. I've learned how to not trick myself, but I've put in coping mechanisms that, you know, if I finish this part of the task, I write this many words, I, you know, have this team meeting, and I get to pick something from my shiny list to do. And my shiny list are things that need to be done, but things I really just want to do, like
right.
order a new pair of shoes or book our vacation, or where I could have, and I did before, spend hours a day going down that rabbit hole of booking a vacation and get nothing else accomplished. So yeah. Lots of timers now, lots of different structure and time management compared to how I had, what I was taught as a business owner, an entrepreneur, how to implement time management to my company. It's very different for me and how, what works and what doesn't.
Mm-hmm. Well, we feel our way through it, don't we?
Yeah.
Figure it out. You know, that's something, ADD, I wouldn't say ADHD, but ADD is something that, you know, I have fully believed that I have that. I have at times, and right. have tried being treated for it. And at this point, I'm not. And, you know, just because I don't want the side effects of you know, the medication that works for me. And also, I don't know, for me, I've figured out ways to manage it too. And part of it is just creating the kind of life that works well for me.
Right? Absolutely. You know? Yeah. Like yeah. you said, how you have the contract work and, you know, these different, it sounds so cool. Like all of the things your hands are in, you know, from being able to work with the different small groups and have the podcast. And that's definitely one of the ways that those with us with that overactive brain that mm-hmm. needs variety, and that's where I am too, you know. And there's a difference though of being able to use that skill, harness that power, if you will, that hyper focus and ability to multitask, I think is really one of the superpowers of those with a neurodivergent brain. But at the same time, it can also be one of the weaknesses if we aren't careful and know how.
Well, and that's true with just about anything.
Everything, right?
It really exactly. is. It really is.
Is that, yeah.
And, you know, I was talking to one of the guests that I have is a very accomplished painter. Mm. And, you know, she made a comment to me about, you know, not in a judgy sort of way or anything, but, you know, maybe one of these days you'll want to choose one of these things to focus on. And because, you know, a lot of from a creative standpoint, usually, you know, that's what artists do. Right.
Right. Yeah.
Like Hemingway wrote.
Let's go back to that construct there, right?
He fished a lot, too, though.
He did, yeah. Bullfighting. And,
yeah, yeah. Well, yeah. But, you know, like part of the reason why I keep my hands in working with groups is because it, well, first of all, like, I don't remember everything to write about. And, you know, like, I have to see things happening. And the interactions that I watch and the stories that I hear remind me of the lessons that I've learned, which I can then write about. It's food for thought.
Absolutely. Yeah. You know? No, that's a great point. I know photography has been my longest standing occupation and preoccupation. And I've been doing wedding photography 13 years full time now. And so I was an English and art major. Mm-hmm. I said I was an overachiever and got two useless degrees as an undergrad. But I actually planned on going to law school. But the law school was one of those masks that I was mm-hmm. ready and willing to put on to make everyone proud of me. And by everyone, yeah. I mean, you know, the teachers and the you know, my friends' parents. And I did an internship with a lawyer. And I was like, I hate this. I don't want to do this. And so thank God that was before we threw the money into law school. So I taught, and kind of for that same reason, Tom, I felt like I need to have this opportunity. I want to be in the classroom. The things that I've learned about literature and art, I love, and I want to share those, and I want to garner more experience with those. I want to treasure those and keep them to myself a little bit more, or in the intimacy of my little classroom and how special those are. And pretty soon, the hobby of photography became more and more serious. And, you know, I always say I'm a storyteller, and whether that's with a microphone, pen and paper, a camera, It's all about the narrative. And that's how it's all united. And I think for those of us who are multi-passionate, I think it was Fitzgerald who said the most limited of all specialists is the well-rounded man. And I don't mind never being a specialist in anything. I mean, I would say we've really grown our photography company. I'm very proud of where we are with that. But I don't want this at 36 to be my final legacy. Right. This project, you know what I mean? Like, there's so much more, and not just with a camera. Or
and we get
there's
bored.
So much more. Yes. And I think that's great. I think you would be doing a disservice to the world not to continue searching for the ways you can share different things and different, you know, absolutely.
Which is why, you know, I mean, I feel like one of the things I struggled with as an emerging adult was I thought I was supposed to know what I wanted to do with the rest of my life. And there was something wrong with me because I didn't.
Yeah.
And now, you know, as a man in his 40s, I know that's ridiculous. Like, it's too, and, but yet I see all these young guys who experience the same thing. And I just tell them, listen, you're going to change. Your life's going to change. What you want is going to change. Do what you want. You know, if you don't know what you want, follow the people you like, you know, you'll figure it out, but you don't have to have all the answers right now. And in fact, it's unrealistic to think you can, let alone should.
At 18 years old, right? You know, this is what we talk about, the constructs. And my oldest child is, he's almost 12, and which is crazy. I just feel like he came home with us yesterday. Mm-hmm. But you know, that same thing, like almost on a daily, he's like, I think I want to be an architect. Now I think I want to be an actor. And I'm like, just keep exploring it. Great. You know, let's sign up for some kind of cool online class, or, you know, look into some of our friends who do that. And, you know, there was nothing for me more impactful and eye-opening than interning. I interned with a lawyer. I interned at a news station. I subbed before I decided definitely what program to apply for in grad school. And those real life experiences, it gives you a better, like you said, being in your groups and hearing the stories. It's just so much more of the big picture and not what you know or think of a certain profession. Mm-hmm. I taught seniors 1 year, and I don't know what that says. I did seniors my last year before my way out. I had remedial seniors, actually.
And you mean high school seniors, not senior citizens.
High school seniors, right.
Okay. At first, I thought you meant senior citizens.
First of all, I love high school seniors, and I love seniors in their golden age. So there's nothing, neither group.
Right.
You're
not discriminating.
I'm not discriminating about any against any seniors, but I had remedial seniors. And what that meant is basically, and this was one of the things I had to look back on in my training during grad school, these students weren't AP English students. They weren't in the regular English class. They were in remedial English, which essentially meant they needed to learn how to do a good resume. They needed to have a general idea of what the works of art were for British literature, because that was the curriculum for that year. But it was functional English, writing the right email, working on the resume, and how to communicate. And, you know, they all had their own path and they all had their own dreams. And instead of pushing as an educator that no, you should be doing something bigger or better, or, you know, these are students who are doing great things. But again, it's not recognized enough in our society because we've built up such a hype around, well, you have to do this profession or be this person. And my whole point to this story is what I came to realize then, and this was impactful for me and something I tell our 12-year-old now, it's so much more important to decide who you want to be as you grow up versus what you want to be. If you can lock in to what kind of man, what kind of woman you want to be 10 years from now, what are the things that you want to be and not are the things that you want to do? That's really what I wish I was told as a teenager, is to focus more on the character you want to continue cultivating, the type of person, like, what do you want to bring to the world? What kind of legacy, what kind of impact do you want to have? And then use your gifts and your experiences to make that into a real thing, whatever that looks like.
Yeah, you know, so much comes to thought. I mean, I was having a conversation today earlier with someone about my parents and what I appreciate, some of the things I appreciate most about them. And it was an old boss. And we were talking about situations where, say, we had an opportunity to demonstrate our integrity.
Yeah.
And lots of people did, and some people did, and some people didn't. But, you know, I remember my mom saying to me one time, I must have asked her, what do you want me to be when I grow up? And I think I was probably early teens. And she said, you know, I don't really care. I just want you to be a good man.
Yeah.
I want you to be honest. Mm-hmm. And probably, and I didn't figure this out until my early 30s, really. I guess I knew, I acted it out in my early 30s the first time demonstrably, that they also taught me that I am to stand up for what's right. And I'm not the one who doesn't speak up, you know, that, and right. And that's, you know, there've been times when I've been really disappointed by some of my friends because we're in a situations where something was obviously wrong. And like, I was the only one willing to say something,
right.
You know, but they gave me that, you know. And the other thing, thinking about listening to you, is one of the things I say to guys, especially when they're like trying to figure out what they want to do or they're in the midst of a career change. And I think this is really true. I mean, there are people that they're going to do well wherever they go, no matter what field. They're going to figure it out. They're going to be useful to their employer. You know, that it's. You know, if either it's, I don't know. I think there's something that either you know how to be that way or you don't.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think, so Patrick, my husband, is a project manager, and the irony is not lost on me that someone who is a time expert married someone who has ADHD and complete creative right brain with no logic half the time. But it's been a really great growing experience for us both. We've been married 17 years and continue to grow in ways that, you know, helping each other through the weaknesses. But all of that to say, Patrick's the kind of man that he would thrive at anything and does. And it's sometimes it honestly ticks me off, Tom, because I'm like, here I am 13 years into the photography business, which Patrick actually shoots weddings with me. Mm-hmm. It's a really good opportunity. I only do 10 to 15 weddings a year. That's our model. And then we have a team, an associate team who works under us. And so, but Patrick's actually the one when I was in art school who had to teach me how to use the camera, because despite the fact my reading comprehension was my strongest, you know, my strongest suit,
I could not do technical writing.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. I was a visual learner when it came to anything like that. And he was a mechanical engineer, so that worked out well. He just rebuilt an engine. He 3D prints things. He's just,
wow.
I mean, he repairs, like, my blow dryer stops working. And he's like, I can fix it. And I'm like, what? And he fixes it. I'm like, what is that? Like, what? Nobody knows how to do this kind of stuff. How do you know how to do everything? It's probably not even human. It's probably like
my daddy's a fixer. That's what he would call me, a fixer.
How old is your little boy?
He's not little anymore. He turns 15 this month.
Oh, he's still your little boy. I always say they're always your babies. So
yeah. But I, you know, I'm like you in that. I mean, I have an array of interests, and I like that about myself. You know, I like that I'm in all kinds of things. And what I tend to do is find something that really I can get excited about. And then I get a little obsessive about it. I specifically do that with music.
Yeah.
I find an artist I really like, I'll like get their whole catalog, learn, you know, just learn all this trivial information about them, you know, just really get immersed in it, you know?
But I enjoy that. I always say those are the rabbit holes I love to live in. And, I do. I know exactly what you mean. We'd probably make great contestants, like on Jeopardy.
Yeah. Well, I think so. I think so. Yeah. I think I could. I've thought about that before. I mean, some of those people just amaze me the way that they can answer questions in any category, and they look like people who wouldn't know the answer to that question, that kind of thing. You know, and the jobs that I've had. I mean, my life took a big hard turn. I was a carpenter and, you know, I drove a Zamboni for a while, if you know what that is.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, you know, I did that for a couple of years and written for newspapers and I love it. You know, it makes life interesting. And why would I want to limit myself to that'd be boring to me to not have a broad array of interests. You know,
when again, I think if we looked back at everything and did a classic, you know, middle school education Venn diagram for you, we would find an overlapping, and you probably already know, right? Whatever that is. Again, for me, so far, I found it's just the love of the narrative, and whether that's working with people directly and understanding their story and coaching them on the business side based on their unique abilities and the things that they've experienced and want to be, or if it's documenting the wedding day and telling the story of that couple. You know, I've said for the last 13 years, I've told hundreds of stories, and now I'm finally telling my own. And it's something early on I wanted to do, but I was so detached from the narrative. I was so detached. And I have found since diving into this and kind of opening up this wound that I swore didn't exist in my early 20s, I'm more in love with the narrative, and I'm more in tune with other people and their narratives. You know, it actually has given me a different perspective and new love for storytelling.
Mm. You know, I interviewed someone yesterday who's an interior designer, but also uses it as a way to coach people. And she was talking about, you know, how we curate our surroundings. And that's something that's always been really important to me. Like, and I talked to her about, you know, people have commented to me as they go through my home and they see this and that, and, you know, everything has some kind of meaning. And I realize as I'm talking to you, they each have a story. That's what it is.
Exactly.
And I asked somebody not long ago, do you think I'm a good storyteller? And they're like, for God's sakes, absolutely. You're a great storyteller. But I just didn't see myself that way, you know, for some reason.
Why do you think that is? Is it the term storyteller? I mean, it is maybe, a little kitschy.
Maybe. I don't know. But, you know, I had an experience recently where I had an opportunity to tell my story.
Yeah.
And had an opportunity to see how someone else might try to tell my story versus how I would tell my story. And as I started taking the parts of this narrative and moving things around and thinking about what do I really want to say about myself? What am I about? I think there's part of me that I'm just not presumptuous. And I'm not big on labels either. And I just, you know, haven't necessarily thought of myself that way. But, you know, I interviewed my high school journalism teacher not long ago.
And
we've stayed in touch. And one of the things he talked about is the fight that he was in to try to get them to keep journalism in my high school because, you know, those kids always did better in English on the SATs. I mean, journalists know how to write, and that's what it was about, you know? And I just had an opportunity recently to realize like I'm a journalist. Like, that will never be not part of what I am.
Well, and, Tom, and I would say that's like absolutely how I feel. It's that those rabbit holes of facts and collecting the data and the information and the stories. And there's so much obsession on my part with that. That's why I made a good English student, because of all the research. I loved the research, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, and one of the reasons why I feel like a real gift for me, both in my sobriety and in my work, is that I'm inquisitive and I want to learn about myself.
Yes. Yeah.
And, you know, guys who don't have that, man, if they don't want to talk about that, you know, it's hard to heal.
It is. There's definitely an advantage there of that growth mindset, right? And especially, I say at our age, I think we're close enough in age, because I'm...
Well, you know, I'll go with that.
I'm closer. I'm now this year, like I'm closer now to the next number than I was to the 3-0.
I'm closer to the next number too, I hate to say.
Well, good. I think decade celebrations are great reminders of like where we are, what we've done, and what we still want to do. So... but I definitely think at our age and having the professional experience and having, you know, had the wins and the ups and downs, to still be receptive to, I want to continue learning. I want to know more. It's not always something I see in people who are doing well in their field and do have a certain, you know, status quo or known as someone to go to for their art or their knowledge. And I think that those are the people, in my experience, who either continue doing it out of boredom, or, you know, they're overly dedicated because they have no other drive. And that burns out. Like discipline without that, you know, want to get better, know better, just doing and doing without learning how to do better, I think burns out so many people from entrepreneurship, and especially in the wedding industry.
I imagine. So now you have a love for photography. How did that begin? I mean, when I ask you that, I assume you ended up doing weddings as a practical expression of that and a way to make money doing that. Is that right?
It's funny, Tom. I mean, now in hindsight, you know, it's always great looking back, and again, not being too much of a label maker for all the seasons that I remember. But I didn't have heirlooms. I didn't have, and even now I started ancestry.com. I don't know if you've gone down that rabbit hole. That's a great rabbit hole. And I realized, and to me, this was a little odd. I didn't know my grandmother's name. My mom's mom died when she was 5. And my mom was one of 6 girls, all struggled with some form of addiction in their life. And none of them are alive. All of them have since passed. And my grandmother died at my age of breast cancer, right after she had the youngest girl. And I was like, I don't even know her name. I mean, you know, it's not a great, great grandmother. It's my grandmother.
Right.
So I think for me, becoming a mother and seeing friends as I grew up who had that history and that rich history of stories, and knew where they came from and had those memento of whether it was an heirloom jewelry piece or a photo. And I longed for that. I wanted that narrative. And in a lot of ways, me choosing wedding photography, I think, that continuous affirmation, people are really happy when you deliver their pictures. And I will say, you know, I won't say I'm really good. I'll say I work really hard at it, and it really is important to me. So there's that level of affirmation that over the years I clung to. It was oxygen for me. You get really close to your clients, and in a very, probably now as I've worked through this, in a faux unhealthy way, would become part of their family. You know, the wedding day, I was so immersed in their story. The narrator oftentimes can see him or herself as a character. And I definitely felt a sense of belonging and a sense of need and
that significance.
Exactly. Yeah. And not just because of what I was doing, but who I was to these people, to my clients. And I still value that, but I don't put my worth in that. If you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
That used to, I used to define myself by that. Now I value it. So photography in itself, though, I always had a disposable camera. Surely you remember.
Of course.
And, you know, we didn't have a real camera in my home growing up, but anytime I could, I saved up money for disposable cameras and one-hour photo at Walmart. And I had pictures of everything I could. Unfortunately, it was mostly, you know, a bird outside or random things. I don't have a lot of family pictures. But my mother, just before I officially moved out, had ordered a Minolta 35mm camera from Fingerhut. Which is like I don't know, Fingerhut. Okay. I was like, is that still a thing? And this was one of the times that I definitely lied. And our house burned down when I was 14. My mother had been using again, and she said a candle was knocked over. But there were times that she would fall asleep with a cigarette in her hand. And so I don't know what happened, but that's what I suspect. And I had that camera with me. I had been at a friend's house, and she had to go to the burn unit. She had some significant burns. And I remember the first time I talked to her, and she asked me if the camera had been at the house. And I told her it was, because I didn't want to give it back. It was the one thing that I just wasn't going to let her have, you know? And it was the first real camera I had, and the first real thing that, in a lot of ways, at 14, I took from her and kept for myself. And refused to let her be part of. So I think, you know, it's easy to look at that now and see those pieces. I didn't know that at 20 when I started, you know, pursuing this.
Well, and, you know, it's an expression of your individuation, right?
Yeah. For sure.
Yeah, you know, are you familiar with ACA? Adult Children of Alcoholic and Dysfunctional Families?
No, but it sounds like a great place for me. I'm going to write that down.
it's been a game changer for me. You know,
yeah,
it really has. And also the book Facing Codependence by Pia Melody.
Yeah, Codependent No More.
No, there's another one. There's Melody Beatty. That she wrote.
That's Codependent the one.
No
yeah.
More. And then there's Facing Codependence by Pia Melody.
Okay.
Which is, you know, I mean, I don't know that one's better than the other. I like Pia Melody's book. It's really practical and kind of brief, and it talks about trauma from, and codependency. From the perspective of this is where it comes from. This is what it looks like in your childhood. This is what it looks like as you become an adult. And this is how you pass it down to your kids.
Yeah.
And I mean, it was just such an eye opener for me.
When did you read that, Tom? How long ago has that been?
That was about 2012.
That's awesome. I'm writing this one down.
And I recommend it
no more.
Yeah. I recommend it to a lot of clients. What were you going to say? Codependent No More.
Yeah.
I
read it about a year ago. I mean, it was pretty recent, and I will say it is one of the books that changed my life. Again, seeing my value and what I bring to my clients, but not putting my identity in that.
Right.
And not, you know, really understanding what it looks like to set personal boundaries and protect my time and protect myself in a way that makes me a better.
So that's all pretty new to you, that stuff.
Very new. Yeah.
This is stuff I've been working on for 25 years at this point.
Like, this is why I asked you. Yeah. I was like, how long ago was that for you?
Yeah.
This is still, you know, I'm still so anxious when I type out an email that I am putting down firm boundaries, but being professional, I still get those butterflies, you know, get that mm-hmm. pit in my stomach. And I'm like, no, Alicia, this is what we do. And my managing director, I have, Anna works with me, and she's also one of our photographers. And she, has been so like a proud mama bird since I've read this book, because she's like, they just don't know you read this book about codependence, and now they can't step on you anymore. Mm-hmm. And, I just think it's important, especially in the event industry, the service industry.
People can be really demanding and
nasty. Yeah, and it's easy to give in. And you can have a servant's heart without having it trampled on. And that's what I'm learning. And that's what I'm continuing to work towards.
Absolutely. Yeah, doing what I do, you can't not. Well, I mean, I can't not have boundaries, because you'll work yourself to death. And, you know, in order to help someone else, you really have to take care of yourself. I mean, because the first rule is, you know, you got to model healthy behavior.
Yeah.
I believe addiction is really rooted in codependency.
Oh, I totally agree. Yeah.
So, and it's, you know, they're different expressions of the same problem. But the thing about Pia Melody's book, once I figured this out, I mean, I was already doing this work for a long time before I read that book, and somebody mentioned to me, and I'd heard the term codependent thrown around liberally for many, many years, you know, and really using it interchangeably with enabling or not having boundaries or loving someone you shouldn't love or, you know, all kinds of different stuff. And, you know, somebody pointed out to me, you know, there are 5 core symptoms. And I didn't know that. I didn't know that. That's what comes up in Pia Melody's book that you don't find other places, the 5 core symptoms of codependence. And it both made me happy and also made me mad, because once I realized what they were and, you know, that they exist, there's so many people who use that label
that
suffer from it themselves. It's like a weapon. It's weaponized. And it's a way to, pathologize somebody. You know,
exactly.
When really, is just trying to figure out how to love. That's what it is, you know.
Yeah. Trying to understand.
Themselves. Yeah.
Exactly. And I think that for me, and this was again just such a great time reading the book, and then you know understanding more about. I say understanding more. There's not many people in my family still alive, on my mom's side especially. And on my dad's side, this is kind of what I'm working through now. You know, I've embraced the fact that this story is the story of how I grew up and remember my parents. And I have a very visual memory. And it's not anyone else's story. If anyone else wants to write the book about it, they can write their book. Right. Mm-hmm. But it's also a very honest look at the things that everyone knew that they struggled with and went through, but not necessarily the things that everyone knew I experienced at their hand. And it's hard piecing these things back together and looking back on how did I feel at that age? Where were we? I've started mm-hmm. with the facts. And that codependent element as a little girl, being afraid to be with my mother and afraid to be without her.
Right.
And she was my main caregiver, and she would tell me, you know, if you tell anyone that you found these drugs, or if you tell anyone that this happened tonight, or if you tell anyone that we went here, you'll never see me again. Is that what you want? Do you want to be taken away and never see me again? And there's an element that even I thought, you know, I want to be taken away. I want to, you know, I want to go to my grandmother's. I always felt secure there. But as a little girl, as a child, there's this fear of losing your parent forever that, you know, I was afraid of how she would survive without me. And I knew she wouldn't. So I feared that. I feared losing her forever, or the idea of her. And that immediate bonding of codependence, and she definitely mirrored that. I can totally see how that became the platform, the foundation of how my relationships, friendships, everything moving forward, how I experienced loving someone and trying to prove myself to them.
All right, there you go. Part one with Alicia in the books. Thanks for checking it out. Part two will be coming soon. So you can subscribe, like, follow the show on Amazon, Apple Podcasts, Breaker, Google Podcasts, Listen Notes, Overcast, Pandora, Podbay, Podcast Addict, Podchaser, Radio Public, Spotify, Stitcher, and you can find the show on YouTube. If you enjoy listening to the show, please take the time to leave a rating or a review, preferably at Apple Podcasts. If you have an Android device that you're listening on, it would be helpful for you to do it at Podchaser, but wherever you're willing to leave love, I'll take it. So, questions or comments, you can call 561-247-4757. Leave a message. I'd love to hear from you. If you know someone who would enjoy this or a particular episode, if you know they'd like the show in general, please send them a link. I try to make it pretty easy to do that on the website. You can send episodes via email, share them all over social media. I want to thank the band Punk Rock Opera, whose music you can hear throughout the show. Their songs are used with permission from the artist and under a Creative Commons license. Thank you to the show's sponsors, The Manor and Windrose Recovery. Also, thank you to Wendy Chen at Equivox. And The Path to Authenticity is proud to support the I Speak Media Foundation. So again, please check out my Clubhouse profile. I'm going to be hosting some talks there, some rooms. I set up a club for the podcast, got some cool things in the works there, and I feel like it'll be a good way to use to maximize the content that comes from producing this podcast. So check out the website, thepathtoauthenticity.com. You can email the show at thepathtoauthenticity@gmail.com. Like us on Facebook. Follow us on Instagram. Have playlists on Spotify that you can check out. Links for all this stuff in the show notes. I'm actually looking for a more substantive way to share music with you guys. It's something that I really wanted to do with this podcast from the get. And, you know, just haven't been able to do it the way I want to yet. So thanks again to Alicia Crossley. Please check out part two of this conversation coming soon. Take care of yourselves and each other. Be nice. Thank you.
We need a guitar player.
The Path to Authenticity is powered by Equivox. For digital marketing and web design services, visit equivox.com.